Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
Look, there's been fires in California from time immemorial. We know that. But we also know that the temperatures are rising. The annual mean temperature is going up. And that then, when combined with years of drought, means that the conditions are worse. They're drier. And therefore, these fires are acting more aggressively, more unpredictably. So we have to do something about it. A lot of what you have to do is fight the fire, is have the equipment, invest the money. But longer term, the climate is changing. And that means the weather is going to be hotter and more unpredictable. So we have to do something about it.
Governor Jerry Brown last night talking about the Valley and Butte wildfires raging in Northern California. More than 700,000 acres have burned and thousands have fled their homes. Governor Brown is calling these fires some of the worst in California's history. And he's warning that climate change is only going to make the fires worse in the future. Well, the world's two biggest greenhouse gas emitters are meeting at a climate change summit today in Los Angeles. The U.S.-China Climate Leaders Summit is the first official meeting between U.S. and Chinese leaders to discuss ways to combat the worsening climate situation. Both nations face similar challenges when it comes to reducing carbon emissions, and they've set ambitious goals for the next 10 years. Coral Davenport is the energy and environment correspondent for the New York Times. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Madeline. It's great to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. There has been not so much progress on creating a global plan for climate change. So what do you expect out of this meeting?
Actually, there has been a tremendous amount of progress towards moving ahead to a global climate change agreement. We saw a tremendous breakthrough in the deadlock towards that agreement last November when President Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping announced joint plans to move forward with parallel domestic policies to cut emissions in both countries. And since then, ahead of a plan to move ahead with a global accord this summer, we've seen countries representing up to 70% of the global economy move forward, make similar announcements, make those plans public, and both the U.S. and China they've made their plans public, and both the U.S. and China have also started actually implementing those plans. That's a really big difference. Ahead of earlier efforts to try to create such a global warming plan. So going ahead into this Paris Agreement in a couple months, we're in a very different place than we've been ahead of similar efforts, for example, in Kyoto in 1997 or Copenhagen in 2009.
Okay, so that sounds good. That sounds promising, even though India hasn't signed on. But China and the United States, the two leading emitters of greenhouse gases, have agreed to what? Reduce global emissions by 28% for the U.S. by 2025 and by 2030 for China?
Yes, that's right. And in addition to putting out those top line numbers, what's really important is that both countries, both governments have put forward publicly detailed plans on the policies that they will implement at home. In the United States, the sort of centerpiece of President Obama's policy is a set of EPA regulations to force cuts in emissions from coal-fired power plants and also from automobiles. So we're seeing both of those regulations have now been made final. Industry is going to be forced to move forward and implement those regulations. In China, the Chinese government has put forth a plan to create a national cap and trade system along the lines of what President Obama tried and failed to do in the U.S. So we are seeing, these are still first steps, but these are concrete policy steps.
So what happens today?
So what happens today is this is the first meeting between senior climate negotiators from both countries. This is the meeting happening in L.A. today between the senior climate change negotiator for the U.S., the senior climate change negotiator for China, and also mayors and governors from many cities and states and in China, several major cities and Chinese provinces, where they're doing a kind of a subnational agreement. About a dozen cities in each country are jointly moving forward with city-level commitments to emissions reduction. We're seeing Beijing and other major cities commit to that. Really significantly, even more important, is we're seeing talks starting between California, which, of course, as the world's ninth largest economy, also is a leader in moving forward with a cap-and-trade program. California has a cap-and-trade program in place. California officials are going to meet with Chinese officials about how to move forward with cap-and-trade systems that could potentially link California's cap-and-trade market to a future Chinese cap-and-trade market. Those are big steps forward.
Well, what's interesting also about this is it seems like the action is happening, at least in the United States, on a local level, in a state level and a local level, because, as you said, there wasn't the ability to make cap-and-trade the law of the land nationally because of opposition on the Republican side in Congress. So is that really where people are looking to now? Is change more on a local level?
Well, just to be clear, local action will not solve climate change. To be clear also, both in the United States and China, the biggest changes are absolutely at the national level. The centerpiece of the U.S. climate change policy is President Obama's EPA regulations that focus on economy-wide emissions from power plants and from vehicles. And so, the changes that we'll see happening in the U.S. are coming from a top-down level. But it's sort of similar to the healthcare plan. The way that regulation works in the United States is every state will be given a target to reduce their emissions, and the states will be allowed to come up with their own plan on how, have state custom-level plans on how they'll reduce those emissions. That wouldn't happen without, the forced regulation from the top. And so we're kind of seeing a mix of, these top-line numbers coming from Washington, but states given the flexibility to figure out, what works for our local and regional economy. And the same thing is happening in China. The Chinese government is talking about implementing a national cap-and-trade policy. Before they implement it, what they've done is there are seven provinces in China that have already begun pilot cap-and-trade programs. Each one of those cap-and-trade programs is different. They're sort of testing out what works for different regions, what works for different kinds of economies. And that's the context in which we're seeing some of these provinces meeting with California, sort of looking at, what works for the California economy, what works for different state economies if you have a more heavily manufacturing state, what works. So the overall policy is coming from the national level, but we're seeing that the states and the regions kind of figuring out how do we customize it, how do we customize it for our states or regions?
Yeah. So, but I'm wondering, though, because these are EPA regulations and, again, not the law of the land in terms of a law that Congress has enacted, if they can just be scuttled if another president comes into office who doesn't like them.
Well, just to be clear, they are the law of the land. The EPA regulations were put forth under the Clean Air Act, a law passed in 1970. They're put forth under the requirement of a couple of Supreme Court decisions and then followed up with court order deadlines. The administration had no choice but to put forward these regulations, and they're put forward under existing law. The question is, what will happen? So what will happen with these regulations? The fate of them will be decided by the courts. These regulations will be challenged in court. They will almost certainly go before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court will determine, are these regulations too strong? Do they follow the law under which they were issued? The future of these regulations sort of will largely be determined by what happens in the courts.
Okay. And so given the fact that China and the United States are working so well together now on this particular issue, do you expect them to be able to inspire other countries, high polluting countries like India, to also come on board?
That's the aim. That's the goal. That's what President Obama and President Xi hope to do. As I said, we've seen countries representing about 70% of the global economy come forth with similar plans. India is the world's third largest polluter. The Indian government has signaled that they do intend to put forward a plan. They're likely expected to unveil that plan next week at the UN, during the UN General Assembly. The question is how strong India's plan will be. A lot of interesting politics between those three countries, China, U.S., and India. India does not want to be seen as being influenced by China or following China. India is primarily concerned not with reducing emissions, but rather with lifting millions of people from poverty. So that is a really important and interesting question that we'll be looking forward to next week. India is putting out its plan. How strong will it be? How serious will it be? How committed will they be to actually moving forward with emissions cuts? A big difference between what we've seen between India and China is China's plan includes a commitment to a peak year for emissions, a year after which emissions will no longer go up, they will only go down. China has pledged a year of 2030 for peak emissions. India has so far indicated that they will not have a target for a peak year. They have signaled that they will not put forth, commit to a year after which emissions go down. Maybe that will change. Maybe it won't. Mm-hmm. These will be some of the policies to look for when India puts forward its plan, possibly as soon as next week.
Coral Davenport, energy and environment correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Great to be with you.
And speaking of climate, you may have noticed that it is raining today. Well, it's tapering off a bit now. How would you describe your commute this morning? Tweet us at KCRW Press Play. Keep it clean, please. All right. Not everyone is going to be unhappy if global warming makes California hotter and drier. The bark beetle, for instance. When trees are stressed by drought, they're more vulnerable to beetle attack. Right now, bark beetles are having a field day. They've eaten their way through 46 million of the 850 million acres of forested land from Canada all the way down to Mexico. And all of those dead trees could be bad news for firefighters who are currently tackling major wildfires in northern and central California. Diana Six is a professor of forest entomology and pathology at the University of Montana. Anna, welcome to you.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So you've been studying these bark beetles. Hi. And why are they so attracted to these drought conditions?
Well, one of the things that they're really attracted to is that the trees are weakened. And so they don't have the strong defenses they typically would to fight the beetles off. There's also another aspect, and that's with warmer temperatures, they tend to have greater reproductive capacity, so they produce more young and have better survival over the winter. So you end up with a situation with lots of beetles and then trees that are very easy for the beetles to kill. And then you have basically, just the perfect fuel for an outbreak.
Right. And so how many trees have been lost to the bark beetle?
Oh, we don't know. Billions.
Billions?
It's the millions and millions of acres from Canada all the way through the West. It's really hard to even estimate the acreage. We don't even have good estimates, but it's a lot.
Okay, we have Tom Coleman now. He's an entomologist with the U.S. Forest Service here in Southern California. And so are we seeing here in Southern California the devastation that these beetles have wrought?
That's right. Most of our tree mortality has been occurring in the western part of Southern California on the Los Padres, and this is primarily linked to the elevated drought we've been seeing for the past 4 years.
And so the trees themselves, from what I understand, they're not able to fight back as well in dry conditions because they can't produce the sticky sap that the beetles don't like. That's right.
I mean, with especially several years of drought, typically we start to see elevated tree mortality after a couple of years in California. And so with increased tree stress, they're not able to physically kind of push out the bark beetles when they are getting attacked. So this resin or pitch will forcefully push the beetle out. And as Diana mentioned, yeah, I mean, so we have millions of trees on the landscape that are highly susceptible to bark beetle attack at the moment.
Okay, so what's the Forest Service doing to fight back against the beetle?
A lot of our work right now is looking at mapping a lot of the tree mortality in Southern California and south and the Southern Sierras. We do put a lot of our efforts at prevention thinning for reducing the risk of bark beetle attacks. And recently with the increase in elevated tree mortality, it's trying to maintain safety in a lot of our high-use sites, so campgrounds or picnic areas or along roadways is a lot of our effort recently.
So by prevention thinning, you mean cutting down otherwise healthy trees?
That's right. So a lot of our stands are over-dense, and so by reducing the competition among these trees, it's similar to kind of the drought. So we're helping them promote individual tree health where they can fight off these bark beetle attacks, but in overly dense stands, they're competing for water and competing for nutrients, and they're not able to fight off these beetle attacks. So by reducing the stand densities, they can promote tree health and prevent these kind of widespread bark beetle mortality events.
And Diana Six, what do you make of that? Do you think that's a good strategy?
I think it works in some situations, and it works to a point in the face of drought. But I think that once you have an extensive drought over a long period, even the trees in thin stands can go down. And that's one of the things we've seen across Montana is, even with our extended drought, that even with thinning, a lot of these things fail. So that's one of the problems with climate change is that, you know, a lot of our tools that we have at our advantage, you know, our disposal, may begin to fail as these droughts become really prolonged and as we see increasing warming over time.
Is there any upside to the beetle infestation of the forests?
I think that in some ways, it's hard to say upside when you see so many trees have been killed and that the outbreak is so much bigger than any we've seen in the past. But one thing we're looking at is that some of the remaining trees, the ones that survived these outbreaks, may have kind of a genetic component that'll help them be more adaptive to future conditions. There's some evidence that these trees grow better under warmer, drier conditions and that they actually have better defenses and that there's a genetic component to the ones that actually survive. Even when you see these really big areas where it looks like almost, you know, where everything looks like it's been killed, if you go out there, there's always these survivors, and there does appear to be a genetic difference in these. So maybe we can capitalize on that and use some of these trees to help us see how we can best allow these forests to adapt to different conditions of the future.
So, Tom Coleman, would that be possible for the Forest Service to take some of these trees and try to replant them in areas of beetle infestation?
Oh, certainly. If there's a desire to go in and replant some of these kind of severely impacted areas where Diana is speaking at, where you see such high levels of tree mortality, they're certainly kind of do the best measures to put some of the best, you know, seed type on the landscape for that area, and certainly something that's more resistant to bark beetles in the future.
So you would take the trees that seem to have this genetic predisposition to defend themselves against the beetle and put them back in these places and try to propagate those kinds of trees?
That's right. The same kind of work is already going on for certain seed zones. They'll plant seed from the same area that is adapted to those sites. So if it's a drier site, they'll try to collect seed that's some from trees that are more adapted from these xeric, you know, kind of landscape areas.
And so, Diana, very, very quickly, what do you envision happening and what do you think our forests are going to look like, let's say, 10 years down the line?
I think no matter what we do, and I do believe there are some things we can do to manage, I think we're going to see some really different forests. A lot of the predictions are that areas will be warmer and drier, and so we'll have some pretty serious reductions in forest cover. And so some areas will probably become shrub and grasslands. And I think that we're just going to have to face the fact that there's going to be change. The thing is that I think that by looking at genetics and the adaptability of our forests, we can probably do some things that will help our forests do better.
All right. I want to thank you both very much. Diana Six, professor of forest entomology and pathology at the University of Montana, and Tom Coleman, entomologist for the U.S. Forest Service here in Southern California. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Coming up, now that it's okay to be out in the military, gay veterans try to get their less than honorable discharges changed to honorable, and they find it's not that easy. That story is next on Press Play.
If you love discovering new music, check out the KCRW Music Mine. It's KCRW's first iPad app, dedicated entirely to music exploration. The Music Mine takes you into a galaxy of audio, video, and photos of artists from the KCRW playlists, with rolling updates so you can uncover what's next and keep up with the artists you love. Discover, listen, share in the Music Mine, KCRW's free iPad app. More info at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Until Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed 4 years ago, gays and lesbians could be discharged from the military. Now there's an effort to change their less than honorable discharges to honorable ones, and that could affect tens of thousands of people. One of them is Jake Hoffman, a former member of the U.S. Air Force, and he's here now. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Nice to have you. Also joining us, Lori Gum. She helps veterans through the process. She works at an LGBT community center in Ohio. Hi, Lori.
Hello, Madeline. Thank you for having us.
Good to have you. Well, Jake, let's start with you. Tell us your story. You were less than honorably discharged, and this was in 1987?
Correct.
And somebody had accused you of being gay. And then so you were questioned, and then were you immediately kicked out?
No. I was taken to an office, and I was interrogated, and they wanted me to tell them other names of who I was having sex with on the base. And at that point, I was a virgin. I hadn't been doing anything with anybody, but they were interrogating me for hours to find out who I'd been doing something with, and I couldn't give them any names. So then after that, they had put me through a couple of weeks of intensive therapy.
Wait, the therapy, what was the therapy for? To make you straight?
Correct. They were trying to see what they could do to correct this illness, and that's how they were labeling it.
Well, and this is in 1987.
Correct.
So not that long ago. So you left, and you have this dishonorable discharge on your record?
And it stayed that way until recently. And a year ago, this past June, I started to file an application and do all the documentation that was necessary. And thing is that I had just kind of given up on all that, and my husband now, he started to make me believe in myself and to learn that the military experience that I had was honorable and that I should and I deserve to be treated respectfully and honorably. And with him helping me to see that, I filed the application and I found out what I needed to do and sent off the packet. And it was almost a year later, which was this past June, I received my new updated DD-214 in the mail with honorable discharge listed.
Lori Gum, how many veterans that you work with have similar stories?
We have worked with six veterans this year. We just started the program last year here in Central Ohio. It's amazing the diverse experiences that are represented by the veterans that come into our office. Unfortunately, the horrible experience they have is common, but how they got to that is very different and reflects sort of the different attitudes over the generations. We have had, as I said, six. Three of those veterans have sort of stopped in the middle of the application. And this goes to the heart of why this process can be so difficult and why we believe it helps to have an advocate, which we are here at Stonewall. You know, some of these stories are buried very deep. I've been working with a veteran the last 2 months. This happened to him in 1955, 60 years ago. No one except his daughter even knew this happened. So they're buried deep. So when you apply, you have to write a narrative about what happened and then what you've you've done with your life. And very often we get to that point after getting all the military records and we're ready to write this, and they don't want to revisit that painful place. So we have to get through that hurdle first. You know, the military records we get are staggeringly incomplete, redacted. The older a veteran, 82 years old, I have been working with, his files were burnt in 1993. And when the burden is on the veteran to make the case about the error or the injustice that happened, very often you don't even have the papers to do that. So it's very challenging. And regardless of even if we don't have records, we keep filing and we keep requesting any records and all that kind of stuff. But the process can be very painful. The process can be very tedious and frustrating. And, you know, this has sort of been our experience so far in being an advocate for these veterans.
How many veterans do you think nationwide could have their dishonorable discharges upgraded to honorable?
Well, to give you an idea, and again, those statistics can be kind of muddy just because of record keeping, as I said, and the difficulty in a lot of these records being complete. The recent Restore Honor to Service Members Act, just introduced into Congress, said that there have been 100,000 veterans since World War II to the repeal of DADT discharged for being, quote, homosexual. And only 500 individuals have actually applied for a correction of military records or an upgrade. So again, like our 82-year-old veteran, unfortunately, you know, a lot of these people have passed. So we don't really know. We're hoping stories like this and national attention can get more veterans to come forward and do this. And so, to be honest, we really don't know. You know, there's that 100,000 number, which is staggering, but we don't know how many veterans. We don't have any numbers like that specifically from the archives or the VA or the government at all, that we know how many are eligible to do this.
And it's not just a question of restoring your honor. It's actually tangible. There are things that you can get when you have an honorable discharge that you can't get when you have a dishonorable discharge, and namely benefits, health benefits.
Absolutely. And we see some of our older vets sort of being forced into the situation. They're older. They may be running out of money. Their Medicare is not necessarily covering everything. So we actually do have veterans coming. One of the biggest reasons, again, as you're saying, not just honor, but to try to get some of these benefits. And it's a big deal. So we have very diverse experience. Some just for honor, as I was speaking, our 82-year-old veteran, very successful in his life. He's 82. He's ill. He just wants his record straight. And then, as I said, we have others that are really looking for those tangible benefits.
And I imagine most of those are men, but are there any women also appealing this dishonorable discharge?
Yes, actually, we just got our first woman in about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and she actually had an other than honorable, but it had homosexuality as a reason for separation, and so it wasn't classified as a undesirable or dishonorable, but she wants that corrected. You know, she's very successful, she's doing just fine, but she wants the record set straight. And here's the sad thing that we hear again and again. These individuals entered the military ready to spend their careers in the military. They wanted to retire from the military. And when you look at the successes of their lives, you're thinking, wow, this could have, you know, the Army could, and all of the armed forces could have taken advantage of these amazingly talented people. And for this ridiculous reason, and the talent that has been lost by this atrocious policy is unconscionable. It really is.
And Jake Hoffman, back to you, since you got your honorable discharge status, how has that changed for you in terms of your benefits and how you feel about the military and your service?
With benefits and what have you, I am set up with the VA here. I have all my medical benefits. I'm going to be using VA loan for a home. I mean, I have a house now, but I want to be able to use the VA loan, which I've never been able to use. So there's a variety of different things that I'm working on to learn more about what benefits are available to me now.
Had you not been discharged, do you think you would have made a career for yourself in the U.S. Air Force?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That was my whole intent and purposes of going in the Air Force. I knew that I wanted to be in the Air Force, and I knew I wanted to retire from the Air Force and make that my career. And I got cheated out of that. So it left a really bad taste in my mouth, and I just wanted to forget the whole thing and just kind of push it down. But this was an important thing that I needed to do, and I did it, and I'm so glad that I did. And the day that I got that upgraded discharge, it was an incredible moment for me.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on today and sharing your story with us.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity.
That's Jake Hoffman. He's an Air Force veteran. Also, Lori Gum, Program and Pride Coordinator at Stonewall Columbus and LGBT Community Center in Ohio. Thank you for coming on today.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Well, we want to hear from you. Have you been kicked out of the military for being gay? Or do you know anyone trying to change his or her status? Leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the dancing baby wins. A woman who uploaded a video of her baby dancing to a Prince song wins her case, a case that pitted the recording industry against the internet industry, and later, why pro wrestling is nothing to laugh at.
As weird as this sounds, it's one of the most purely American art forms in the world, and I think it's about time that it gets its due.
Faces and Heels, after a news update with Jennifer Wolf.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Back in 2007, Stephanie Lenz put this 29-second clip of her baby dancing on YouTube.
What do you think of the music?
If you listen closely, you might be able to identify the music in the background. It's the song Let's Go Crazy by Prince. Well, once the video was online, Universal Music cried copyright infringement and the video was taken down. Well, Stephanie Lenz filed a lawsuit arguing that her video was protected by fair use. And that lawsuit has become one of the most infamous in modern copyright law. Yesterday, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco basically found that she has enough of a case to go to trial. And the outcome could change the way we all use the internet. Joining me to discuss this is Sarah Jong. She's a contributing editor at Motherboard. Hi.
Hi.
All right. So we just heard this audio, and it doesn't seem like anyone would actually listen to that instead of the actual Prince song. So why did Universal care so much?
Actually, Prince is really touchy about his intellectual property. And so at the time, Universal was really looking out for Prince songs on YouTube.
And so it issued this takedown notice. And briefly, what is a takedown notice?
A DMCA takedown notice is... it's what happens before a lawsuit. The DMCA is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and it has multiple provisions. One of the provisions sets up this notice and takedown system. If you have, say, a song and you see it posted without your permission on YouTube, you are able to send this DMCA notice to YouTube to have that video of your song taken down because you own the copyright.
So that's what happened here, is Universal sent that DMCA to YouTube, which then took it down?
Yep.
So then Stephanie Lenz sued, and I guess most people wouldn't bother to sue. Why did she?
Well, she went to the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Her video hadn't, it had been down for like 6 weeks at this point. She went and saw an attorney. They helped her fill out a counter notice, but they weren't really responding to her. She really wanted her video back up. I suppose she was pretty angry. And the EFF helped her out. And then a short while later, they said, hey, actually, this case is kind of ridiculous. Let's make this into a test case so that we can protect everyone's fair use rights. And so they took on her case pro bono.
Okay, so that brings us to yesterday's decision in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. What did the judges say?
Well, it's a mixed decision. On the one hand, they said, you have to consider fair use before you send a DMCA notice. But on the other hand, they also said, you know, it's not entirely clear that Universal did or didn't consider fair use. And that seems really weird because you look at this video, it's really blurry. You can barely hear the song. There's a kid playing. I think it's pretty obvious to everyone who looks at this that some mom took a video of her kid probably to show to relatives. that's a fair use. How could this DMCA notice have been sent? And how can you objectively say that fair use was actually considered? But the way the law is set up, now it has to go to trial and a jury has to decide whether or not Universal subjectively considered fair use.
Well, the Electronic Frontier Foundation is saying that this is a victory for their side, but you're not seeing it that way?
No. So the good thing is that the court has said you have to consider fair use. However, in order to do that, you would have to like really lawyer up. This is something that is not possible without the EFF taking this case on voluntarily. Ordinary people, especially if, you know, you're just a mother taking a video of your child, they don't have tens of thousands of dollars to, I guess, just make a principled stand.
But in this case, as they said, the judges said you have to consider fair use before issuing a takedown notice. Doesn't that mean that there will be fewer takedown notices issued?
I don't necessarily see that. They basically gave their blessing to automated takedowns. They talked a bit about algorithmic takedowns, basically robotic takedowns, where algorithms match up videos with allegedly infringing content and then issue takedowns. And there's a lot of really dangerous language in there that could really just ensconce in place sort of the system where we have a massive pile of DMCA notices being sent out, and there's no repercussions for, well, frankly, laziness. Like recently there was this story where, you know, the movie Pixels, a pile of DMCA notices got sent to Vimeo, which is another video streaming site. And basically what had happened is someone had searched for Pixels in the title of every video and had taken down indie films, completely unrelated videos. They actually even took down the trailer to their own film. Like the trailer that they had uploaded.
So it's kind of like take down and then ask questions later or ask for forgiveness later.
Exactly. And there's no repercussions. As long as it's as hard to bring a case as it is in Lens, there's no repercussions for doing that.
Okay, so perhaps the stakes are pretty low with a baby dancing in a homemade video. But what about news content? Does this apply to news content? So for instance, if there's a political event that a news organization covers, puts on its website, and then someone else takes that video and puts it on their website, could they be issued a takedown notice?
Yes, under limited circumstances. Like it applies to, you know, news coverage, it applies to political ads, it applies to, well, there was actually like Rush Limbaugh said some nasty things about Sandra Fluke in the last election cycle, and someone took those comments and criticized them and made like a YouTube video criticizing him. And that got taken off of YouTube because Rush Limbaugh issued a DMCA notice. So the DMCA is used to squelch political speech.
And this lawsuit won't necessarily address that part of it?
I mean, it might. It might make things a little easier because in the Rush Limbaugh case, I think he definitely didn't consider fair use before sending that DMCA notice. But once again, because the standard to prove it is so high, it might not be worth going after Rush Limbaugh.
But again, they're going after, or they're sending these takedown notices to the providers, to the YouTubes of the world,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
So couldn't YouTube say, no, we're not going to do that?
Yes. And in many cases, YouTube does say that. And a lot of the providers of the world do say no. Like, for instance, Twitter says no to like a third of the requests they receive. WordPress says no to a third of the requests they receive. So they are doing this. But that said, you still get these stories. You get these really, really ridiculous stories. You get, I mean, I'm sure you've run into this thing where you click on a link and it's like, oh, content no longer available. And mm-hmm. it's something that would have you really, really wanted to see. This happens all the time. And it's kind of something that over the last 8 years, a really sort of sad thing is that we've come to expect this of the internet and we don't expect any better.
And the interesting thing is the burden is on the person who wants to use the material. The burden is not on the owner of the copyright.
Exactly.
Isn't there a provision in the DMCA that actually protects users of this material from frivolous takedown notices?
Yeah, it's called 512F, and it's the provision that Lens is using to sue Universal. If you get a DMCA notice where there's a quote-unquote knowing misrepresentation, you can sue for any and all damages, which is quite huge, actually. But because of the Lens decision and a couple other decisions, It's really hard to use 512F, so hard that legal experts have called it dead.
Sarah Jong, contributing editor at Motherboard, and she was trained as a lawyer, writes about technology, policy, and the law. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
And here we are, we're in Olney, using a Prince song. It's all fair use.
A little fair use there. Might as well use it when you can. We're going to be talking today about a very interesting subject. You know, mass incarceration is now pretty much, by consensus, the result of the excesses of the war on crime signed into law by President Clinton, former President Clinton. Even Speaker Boehner and Mike Lee, very conservative senator, have indicated that they are in favor of criminal justice reform, and there's bipartisan support for it, one of the very few things that has that characteristic. But it appears that now that there have been reports, which many people say are exaggerated, of a rise in crime, the criminal justice reform may be in trouble. So we're going to talk about that. It's very interesting subject.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, Joe Biden was a big proponent of that bill.
Yes. He was, but now he's in favor of criminal justice reform.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Warren Olney. And coming up on this show, how pro wrestling has worked its way into mainstream pop culture. That's next on Press Play.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Back in the 1980s, pro wrestling was to sports what hair metal was to music. Cheesy, over the top, insanely popular. Hulk Hogan, its biggest crossover star, appeared in movies and commercials.
Hey, B, no way a little dude like you is gonna change my ways.
It's time you were tempted with a taste of nuts and honey.
Hulk Hogan doesn't eat nuts and honey.
Did you take this?
Since then, wrestling has faded from mainstream pop culture. For years, it's been treated as a sports sideshow. Now, though, that is changing. Wrestling is again getting its due, and there's more to it than you might think. David Shoemaker is a writer for Grantland and Deadspin and author of the book The Squared Circle, Life, Death, and Pro Wrestling. And his latest story for Grantland is called Why Wrestling Matters. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, why does it matter?
I think it matters because it's really, I mean, as weird as this sounds, it's one of the most purely American art forms in the world. And I think it's about time that it gets its due.
Okay, so break that down for me. Purely American art form. Usually people use that phrase for jazz or maybe Broadway musicals.
Yeah, no disrespect to either of those. But yeah, I mean, listen, when I set out to write a book about wrestling, I decided that I wanted it to start when wrestling became fake. Because, you know, I didn't want to write about Greco-Roman wrestling or anything like that. I wanted professional wrestling. And what I found was, you know, wrestling has been fake for about as long as it's existed. It started off on the, you know, American carnival sideshows in the early 20th century. And when it graduated into arenas as a real sport, it only stayed pure for about 15 or 20 years, if that. And, you know, I just think that there's just something really amazing about this cross performance form. It's you know, one part sports, one part soap opera. A whole lot of it's very reminiscent of ancient theater, but there's something very American about this form, because it's a total farce, and it's a total facade as entertainment.
Yeah, but people pretend it isn't, and so that's part of the fun, is you can just lose your sort of skepticism of it.
Exactly. I mean, listen, I don't want to imply that there have not been fans that were caught up in it and that believed to a large extent that it was true. But, you know, I started looking back in newspaper and magazine archives and figured out pretty quickly that people were very clued into the fact that wrestling was a put on from, you know, as early as the 19-teens. So, you know, I think part of the joy of it now and ever since then has been kind of giving yourself over to it and getting lost in it. And even when you know it's fake, part of the joy is addressing it as if it's real, interacting with it as if it's a real sport. And that's sort of been the secret handshake between the wrestling promoters and the wrestling fans since basically the beginning.
So if everyone knows it's fake and it's just good old-fashioned American entertainment, why was there this stigma attached to it?
Well, I mean, I think for a lot of people who don't watch wrestling, for a long time, they perceived that wrestling fans were dupes, that they did think it was real. you know, I wrote in my piece, every wrestling fan grows up hearing over and over again, you know, that stuff's fake, don't you? And it's just sort of the bane of the wrestling fan's existence, even though we know it's fake. And, you know, we can say that you're the idiot for not realizing that I know that. It still comes up over and over again. I think personally that there's a lot of reasons why pop culture has come around on wrestling over the past few years. But one of the big ones is that pop culture overall has shifted towards this fakery. I mean, you can't be a fan of The Real Housewives and then say, hey, you know, wrestling's fake, don't you? Right. I mean, it's all a put on.
I guess they haven't really admitted that it's fake.
But everybody knows it's fake, yeah. Right? I mean, there was a period at the beginning of you know, this sort of modern reality show. I remember, you know, when, like, The Hills was on MTV, where people would say the same thing. You would say, I like The Hills, and somebody else would say, hey, you know that stuff's fake, don't you, right? But it's just all kind of come back around. That's another way in which I think wrestling is really an incredible form. It was a century ahead of its time.
I think maybe the apex of this, is it fake, is it not, this kind of postmodern moment in wrestling came when Andy Kaufman wrestled Jerry Lawler. Andy Kaufman, the comedian, he went on David Letterman and he said he was injured from wrestling Jerry Lawler. And then they had this fight on TV.
Thank you very much for being here, Andy. Let's take care of your neck injury. Now, when was the match? April 5th, right? Mm-hmm. And it's now almost August. Do you still need that neck brace on there?
Yes. You see, I don't want to sit out here and pretend that I'm friends with this guy because I think he's a wimp.
You're absolutely right. It was a singular moment, and that's why I touched on it in the piece, because it's not unique to wrestling, but it's unique to the sort of crossover style of wrestling. A lot of times they'll have celebrities come in, and it'll be just sort of played for farce. But what Andy Kaufman did, I mean, we all know that he did this in all different walk, you know, in a lot of different ways, and every different sort of performance art that he did, he fully committed himself to the character, and he wouldn't come out of character, and he would never admit what parts were real and what parts were a put on. He brought that over to professional wrestling, and yeah, I mean, just totally brought a bunch of eyes from outside the wrestling world into the wrestling ring, and it was a really impressive performance on his part. But I think what even a lot of wrestling fans miss about it, and what a lot of people who respect what he did miss about it, is that he wasn't deconstructing the form of wrestling. You know, this wasn't performance art for its own sake. He was being a professional wrestler, full stop.
So now we have some big stars coming out of wrestling. We mentioned Hulk Hogan, but also The Rock. He's a big star right now. So there's this crossover appeal.
Two of the most important forces in making wrestling sort of mainstream are The Rock, who proved that wrestlers aren't just this second-rate acting talent. I mean, you know, you can say what you will about The Rock as a dramatist, but he's an incredibly successful actor, and for what he's doing, he's incredibly gifted. And in the same way that he has affected positively the dramatic side, if you will, Brock Lesnar has brought a whole lot of legitimacy to the athletic side after he left WWE and became a champion in UFC and then came back to the wrestling world.
And so is it actually more popular now these days, or just people paying more attention to it?
What struck me and what strikes a lot of people is not so much the hard numbers, but the social acceptance. You know, we've talked about a lot of the reasons for that, but you know, I just know that since I started writing about wrestling, you get a much different reaction when you tell a stranger that you're a wrestling fan than you did, you know, say 5 years ago.
What about the reverse? Has professional sports adopted any of wrestling's techniques? Have they become more like wrestling with their personalities and the entertainment?
Absolutely. I mean, it's impossible to watch UFC, which is sort of the real sport closest to wrestling, and not just see so many aspects of the WWE product. I mean, from the way that they present the fights to, you know, the graphics to, more than anything else, the sort of personality packages they put together about their performers, their athletes before they come on. You know, you're seeing the competitor on his grandparents' farm, you know, baling hay or whatever. I mean, this is a wrestling storyline, right? I mean, this is how you introduce wrestlers to the audience.
The Olympics does that.
The Olympics,
right?
Does it. I mean, and every professional sport now. I mean, the NFL, the NBA, basically, isn't they've had these huge PR for the PR machines in house. They're doing all this for their own athletes, and yeah, you see it everywhere you look. You know, wrestlers kind of charted the course for how you become a superstar in American pop culture.
David Shoemaker, writer for Grantland and Deadspin, and author of the book The Squared Circle: Life, Death, and Pro Wrestling. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Julie Myers.
Hello.
Are you a pro wrestling fan?
I am a fan of a professional wrestler, Madeline.
Who is it?
And I think you and I both smell what he's cooking. That would be The Rock.
You're a fan of his eyebrow.
I love his eyebrow. There's no more, like, there's as much expression in that single eyebrow as other wrestlers do.
And it
can
probably lift a human by itself.
I believe that to be the case. So we asked our listeners about their favorite wrestlers and why they love wrestling. Jocelyn Ortiz tweets that she lived for Vader power bombs when she was a kid. There was just something so gratifying about seeing another human get flattened like a crepe. Brian Lopez tweets that Americans love professional wrestling for the same reason we love comics and Star Wars. It's because there's a clear good and a clear evil, and the storylines are easy to parse. Shelby Erickson is a bit more circumspect. He tweets that the reason, quote, the sport, unquote, is so appealing is that it can mess with reality. When something is scripted, it's easy to infuse with drama. So it's kind of unfair to compare that with that kind of entertainment with sports like football and basketball.
Ah, it's all entertainment. All right. Thank you, Julie Myers. And for some serious stuff, keep it right here. Warren Olney and To the Point up next. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. Stay dry. I'll see you tomorrow.